And you're there, right, Jim?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. So here we go. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Joel Whitaker, editor of Kane's Beverage News Daily and DCGourmet.net. And today on our expert interview, we have Jim Cook, the founder of Boston Beer Company, best known for its introduction and spectacular growth of Samuel Adams Boston Lager and all of the resulting products that came from that early launch. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you?
Well, I'm doing great, but Joel, I got lots of beer here, so life should be good for me. How are you doing?
We're doing well, thank you. All is good. It's a nice, cold, rainy day in outside of Washington, D.C., so we're all set. Tell us a little bit about how you got started, and in fact, tell us a little bit about yourself going way back to, you know, where did you grow up? I know that you are, I believe, the sixth generation of brewers in your family. So tell us a little bit about the family background and what sort of set you up to get into the beer business.
Well, I guess I was sort of born into brewing because my dad was a brewmaster, as was my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, my great-great-great-grandfather were all brewmasters here in the U.S. And, you know, so I was around beer as a kid growing up. But my father became a brewmaster. He graduated from brewmaster school in 1948, and at that time there were about 1,000 breweries in the U.S., and they were mostly doing just fine. And then that massive consolidation took place, and by the time I started Sam Adams in 1984, that 1,000 breweries was down to about 40. So it wasn't the most promising career path, and as a result, you know, I, as a kid, once I got into high school and college, I did not see a future in brewing for me. And then in around 83, I had a job. I was a manufacturing consultant, and I was kind of ready to leave it. And I started thinking about, well, what do I want to do now? And that's when the idea of starting a very small local brewery that would be called Boston Beer Company and make a beer called Sam Adams took root. And I put together some plans. At that point, there was really no craft brewing industry, no microbrewing industry. There were a handful of crazy pioneers like myself, and I had no notion that, you know, Sam Adams would ever take off like it did. My original business plan was that we would grow to 5,000 barrels a year after 5 years, and then that would kind of be as big as we could get, and I turned out to be completely but happily wrong about that, Joel.
Well, that's absolutely terrific. So what? So immediately before you started Boston Beer, you were a manufacturing consultant, and you were in Boston?
Yes. I grew up in Ohio, and then I came here to the Boston area to go to college and went to graduate school here. So I basically stayed, like a lot of people do, in Boston. When I was thinking about starting Samuel Adams, Boston seemed like a good place to do it. And besides, I didn't want to move. You know, I'd been living here for a lot of years. I had a couple of kids growing up here, so I was quite happy in Boston, and it turned out to be just the right place for Samuel Adams.
Did you do any sort of you know, market research, or did you just sort of in your gut think that, well, yeah, I can do this, and I can get to 5,000. Boston will support 5,000.
I mean, my market research was going to bars and talking to people and explaining my idea and see, you know, did they think it was crazy? Were they interested in it? And probably more fundamental than that was my belief that I could, you know, simply with the quality of the beer, create a very small but sustainable market, because, you know, I came from a brewing background, and one thing I did realize is, you know, this is 1984, I realized, wow, I can put the best glass of beer available in front of the American beer drinker. I can make a beer that is more flavorful than the mass-marketed, mass-produced domestic beers, and I can make a beer that is also more flavorful and fresher than, you know, the big imports, which were, you know, hot at that time. Things like Heineken, Corona, you know, Moosehead, Beck's, Labatt, Molson, those Fosters, those were considered the epitome of the brewer's art back then, and I knew that I could do better.
Good. So when you started this up, tell us about the early days. I'm sure that the early days must have been a real struggle.
Well, yes, they were. I couldn't get any distributors in Boston to carry my beer, so I had to go out myself and sell it from door to door. So I'd carry cold beer in my briefcase in a sleeve of cups to get bartenders and bar managers just to taste the beer, because I knew once I could get them to taste it, I would get them interested, and the taste would surprise people, but I thought enough of them would enjoy it that I'd get some customers. And then I also had to lease a truck and go deliver the beer myself, either from my station wagon or from the truck.
Was that experience of actually hand-selling the beer yourself and, frankly, delivering it, was that beneficial or was it not beneficial? How do you see that playing into the way the company evolved over time?
Yeah, my experience of having to sell Sam Adams, you know, from bar to bar, to convince, you know, bartenders, restaurant managers that they, you know, should have a really great American beer was very formative to the company. I realized that, you know, I could build a clientele and a drinker base without, you know, the big advertising budgets and the Super Bowl and the big sales forces and all the things that the big brewers had used, that I had kind of a guerrilla warfare approach that could be successful.
Good. And what was your biggest surprise back in those very early days?
Well, I think one of the most wonderful surprises was 6 weeks after Sam Adams hit the market, it got picked as the best beer in America at the Great American Beer Festival, and that was very exciting. It was pretty cool, not only as recognition for the quality of Sam Adams, but also because it made a very different statement about how a consumer should think about beer. It actually said, wow, there is a best beer in America, it's Sam Adams, and quality really does matter. Because, you know, when I first started brewing Sam Adams, the consumer really didn't think about quality as an element in their beer choice. It was, you know, what advertising you like, and what's the most readily available, and, you know, who's got the hottest chicks on TV, and things like that. People didn't really think about quality as the basis for their beer choice until, you know, things like that happened.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get your first wholesaler? What was the process, if you will?
I guess I'd have to say I earned it, because I, you know, kept slogging away, brewing the beer, selling the beer, delivering Sam Adams, and it started to catch on in Boston, and it started to get noticed. And so the wholesaler, the next town over in Worcester, called me out of the blue and said, gee, I've heard really good things about this Sam Adams. Could I be your distributor, you know, in central Massachusetts? And that was my first wholesaler, Atlas Distributing.
Amazing. And at that point, were you still doing it all yourself, or did you have some people working for you who actually by now were selling and by now were you know, humping the barrels and so on?
No, at that point, I think the company was maybe three people.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, it was still quite small, and I was still hands-on at that point, but, you know, I'm still hands-on today, so that part hasn't really changed.
Right, and I guess that's a really good thing. How critical do you think having that wholesaler was to your ultimate success?
Well, we really needed the support of the wholesaler community to grow Sam Adams. I couldn't do everywhere what I did in Boston, putting cold beer in my briefcase and, you know, going from bar to bar selling it. I could do some of that, but I really needed to be able to hand off that activity to a supporting wholesaler network so that I could begin, you know, to sort of become like the Johnny Appleseed of good beer and start spreading the word of Sam Adams and other good beers outside of, you know, the 100 bars in Boston that we probably had at the time when we got our distributor.
When did you realize that you could become, you know, a big deal, if not national, at least regional? When did you realize you could grow beyond that 100 bars or 250 bars, including the two towns right next to you?
Yeah, I think it was a few months after I launched Sam Adams. You know, what was happening was bars started to call me, you know, and I didn't have to go see them. They would have heard about it or seen it somewhere else and heard good things from their customers, and they would call me and say, gee, I heard these great things from some of my drinkers about Sam Adams. You know, I'd like to order a couple of cases. And, you know, at that point, even a two-case order was an exciting thing. So it started to get momentum beyond my own direct activities and started spreading through word of mouth. And once that happened, you know, I realized that this was much more powerful than I thought, and that, you know, having a really great beer that tasted like nothing that, you know, the beer drinkers had had before was going to be a revolutionary experience.
Yes, I remember that back in the 80s, you know, it really the whole idea was to, or before the 80s, before you came along, the whole idea really had been to come up with the standard beer that everybody in America would want to drink, and Anheuser-Busch was successful with that, Miller was to some extent, and so on, and you really turned that all around amazingly so. When did you start to get beyond that small, that really small microbrewer stage?
Well, you know, in some ways, we're still there, because despite all of this hard work for 27 years, and we're still not even 1% of the U.S. beer business. So all of those same, you know, efforts that helped us succeed back when I got started are the same things we're doing today. We're still, you know, educating bartenders and wait staff about beer, about malt and hops and how beer is made. We're still, you know, educating them about, you know, proper serving techniques for draft beer. So, those things really haven't changed, Joe. We're not on the Super Bowl yet.
So that sort of describes the culture of the company, Jim. But at some point, you went from having a small little brewery to, if I recall correctly, to contracting with a couple of guys to produce larger quantities. And then you bought, I think you bought a brewery in Cincinnati.
Yeah. So that was about 1990, sort of mid-90s,
uh-huh.
When, you know, I felt very comfortable that, you know, that we were onto something with very long-term potential, that it had gone from being a fad to a movement and a revolution.
Right. And that's when you got into the contract brewing stage, I guess, of the business?
No, I actually began as, you know, with contract brewing. And we then built our brewery in Boston a couple of years later. And then in the mid-90s, I made a big jump and bought one of the last of the traditional sort of small batch breweries, which was in Cincinnati.
And which brewery was that?
It was, when we bought it, it was called Hudepohl Schänling.
Mm-hmm.
Very German, Hudepohl dash Schänling, Schoenling.
Right. Good. And that must have been a big jump for you. Were you worried at all when you did it, or did you, I mean, had you gotten to the point that you really needed your own place?
We really needed our own place, and I was pretty confident at that point that, you know, we had built a pretty loyal consumer base that wasn't going to go away. Might have its ups and downs,
but they were loyal. And
yeah, but they weren't going to go away.
Right, and that, I guess, took it out of the big gamble stage into what you essentially told me is that at least at that point you were a very careful, cautious business guy.
Yeah, yes, I think that's right. You know, because I, you know, certainly seen a lot of breweries go out of business during my dad's day.
Now, was this the brewery your dad worked at by any chance?
Yes, he had worked at most of the breweries in Cincinnati when I grew up.
And Cincinnati was, if I recall correctly, I grew up in Indianapolis, and if I recall correctly, Cincinnati was a great beer town.
Yes, built on, it has a very long brewing tradition and, you know, a very strong, you know, German heritage that that, you know, expressed itself in lots. There were five breweries in Cincinnati when I was a kid.
Sure. And
there wasn't just Hudepohl and Schänling, which were two separate breweries, but there was Wiedemann's, Bavarian, Burger.
Yep. And was your dad still alive when you bought that brewery?
Oh, yeah. He's still alive today.
And how did he feel when you bought that brewery?
I think he was very proud.
I would think so. It must have made him quite happy. You talked to us a little bit about how the company was today, in some respects, what it was back in the early days in Boston, where you still do a lot of education and probably less hand selling now than you did back at the start, at least in terms of the sales effort as a percentage.
I still do a lot of that, but we have a lot more salespeople. But
right.
I mean, last week I was working the market in Minneapolis for 2 days in Hartford for a day.
And what's your philosophy now about advertising?
You know, my guess is that for a craft brewer, you know, advertising should be an extension of the education process that has always been important to craft beer in general and Sam Adams in particular. That, to me, I have always believed that my biggest competition comes not from other brewers, but from ignorance and apathy, from people who don't know about beer and don't care about beer. And so any kind of, you know, consumer effort should be centered on educating the consumer so that they will care more about the quality of the beer they drink.
Good. Good. And over the years, you've had to grow the company by hiring additional people. what's your philosophy in hiring people? What do you look for, and when did you realize it was time to put some professional management in place in addition to yourself?
Well, I don't know if we've gotten there yet. My belief is that, a small brewer like Sam Adams has to develop a different set of strengths than a big brewer. Mm-hmm. And that strength has to come from the passion and the pride that an independent company can have. And professional management by itself is a negative, not a positive for a small brewer. So we've always hired people more for their their personality or their sort of character traits. But we've hired people for who are really passionate about beer. Mm-hmm. And are energized by working for a brewery that is focused on making quality beer.
Good.
So it's we want people who are going to be proud to work for Sam Adams and who are going to really take pride in the product we make and their role in creating what we think is some of the best beer in the world. And so we've
Correct.
Tended to hire people who they need to have the requisite skills, but many people do. What we're really hiring is the passion about great beer that they bring. Because there's, there's plenty of professional managers out there, and the big guys have more than their share. If I believe that if a small brewer like Sam Adams is going to be successful, we have to do things differently.
Right. And that certainly seems to have paid off for you over the years.
Absolutely. It's really been the right decision all the way through. Because at our size, we can't compete with the big guys. We have to do things differently.
Right. And but speaking of the big guys, I suppose that now, unlike 1985, say, I suspect when you walk into a room that Dave Peacock would recognize you if you walked into the room.
Yes. Dave Peacock would. But I think, that's as much a testament to Dave Peacock, who is, a very approachable, very well-respected, and a guy who understands that the beer business is about making friends.
Right.
I think Franklin Joel, I think that's more a tribute to Dave Peacock. In all my years in the beer business, I never met August Bush III.
Oh, really?
He never returned a phone call, never answered a letter, never would even, at industry meetings, I could never get to him because he was always surrounded by, a group of people.
Sure.
So he never, he didn't feel any need to extend his hand to a little guy like Sam Adams. But Dave, and we're not that much bigger, but Dave Peacock has done that. And I really think that's a tribute to his, approachability and interest in the industry.
Well, Dave Peacock certainly seems to me to be a first-class guy, and you've just sort of confirmed it. That's a wonderful thing. When did you start your annual homebrew contest?
In the mid-90s.
What led to that?
It was my belief, well, partly, I started started as a home brewer. I had this professional brewing background, but I was also a home brewer. So what I believed was that there were some great homebrew recipes out there, and it was also a time when, you know, people, a lot of beer drinkers made fun of homebrew. You know, they looked down their nose at it, and as a, you know, as part of the homebrewing community, I always thought, wow, there's some really great beers being made by homebrewers in the U.S., and by holding the long shot contest and then bringing these beers into the market, we will show beer drinkers just how good homebrewers are.
Have any of the winners of that contest, I believe you put two a year into your portfolio for a year?
Right.
Have any of the winners of those ever gone on to become permanent members of your portfolio?
No, but several of them have gone on to become professional brewers.
Very good.
Yeah, which is cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Fundamental belief has always been that the line between a talented amateur and a practicing professional is arbitrary and meaningless.
I know a lot of people would agree with you, and I know that there would be a good number of people who would disagree with you. Of course,
the drinkers
are probably the professionals who don't want the competition.
Well, that's right. I'll give you another example, which I just saw this week, and we did a similar thing to the long shot competition in for movies. It was called Project Greenlight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same kind of thing. It gave an aspiring but amateur screenwriter a chance to have their movie actually produced. And we did it in partnership with Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, and Chris Moore, their producer. And we did it, I think the first one was 2001. And there was an insurance salesman in Chicago named Pete Jones. And Pete won it. He was selling insurance at the time. And based on this, he moved out to Hollywood. Anyway, long story short, there's a movie out now called Hall Pass. The Farrelly brothers did it. I think it got released this weekend, so it's a big budget Hollywood movie, and guess who the screenwriter is? Pete Jones.
Very good.
And so it can and does happen.
And you have also, in addition to that, if I recall correctly, you have been actively helping, continue the entrepreneurial movement, not just within the beer community, but outside. And if I recall correctly, you sponsor something, or you donate money, or
yes, it's called the Sam Adams Brewing the American Dream program.
That's it.
And it's basically a micro lending program for low and moderate income entrepreneurs in the food and beverage business. We started in New England, but we've expanded it to Ohio and the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania.
Sort of the places where you have a presence already.
That's right, where we have breweries, because it's not just micro lending. It also involves coaching and mentoring of small businesses. So so it's pretty hands on.
Good. Now, you mentioned the Lehigh Valley Brewery. When did you know it was time to buy that facility?
Well, probably, in the about 10 years ago, I kind of had a feeling that, we were going to end, that sooner or later we would end up buying it. At that point, it was very quickly went from Stroh to Pabst to Diageo. And sort of the writing was on the wall that it probably would, you know, eventually be for sale again. And so it was about that time when we started paying attention to it. And then it turned out to be true. And in, I'm trying to think, I guess it was maybe 2007, we started talking to Diageo and were able to purchase it.
Did you approach them, or was it a case of it had gone on the market, or it was, you know?
I think it was sort of both. We'd had discussions on and off, and, you know, they didn't, and they didn't, you know, we'd have these discussions, and it wasn't quite the right time for both of us. But, you know, I think we both kind of knew that at some point it would be the right time.
And was, you mentioned that you knew about that particular brewery. Was that because that was in an area that you really wanted to have a brewery located, you know, like a central distribution area or something?
It was a little bit of that, but more importantly, it was really the last of the traditional breweries, meaning, you know, it was built in the late 60s, early 70s, before, you know, light beer and modern brewing techniques took over. So it was built in the way traditional breweries were built, with a, you know, a four-vessel brew house with horizontal tanks, and it wasn't built for more modern brewing techniques. It was built for traditional brewing techniques. Things, you know, it wasn't. Since then, pretty much every new brewery of any size has been built for what's called high gravity brewing, which means that you brew a higher gravity, almost beer concentrate, and then add carbonated water to it at the end. This brewery was built for original gravity brewing, where everything gets brewed, goes, you know, it starts in the kettle, and there's no deliberate, you know, cutting the beer down. So it was like the one in Ohio. It was built for traditional craft style of brewing, and the tanks were balanced for that, and, you know, the flow was suited for that. You could do croisening in it, you could do decoction mash, you could do dry hopping, things that are that were very traditional and then were brought back as part of craft brewing. So this was kind of, in a way, the largest craft brewery, the largest physical facility in the U.S. And we were able to buy it for significantly less than it would have cost, you know, to build it from scratch. And if we were building it from scratch, it's exactly what we would have built. It's got a big copper brew house with, you know, direct flame under the kettles, which is an interesting, very traditional technique that nobody does anymore. So it was sort of the once and future brew house, if you will.
And it's a beautiful facility. When you drive by it at night, it shines very much. I used to see it all the time when I would drive, at the time I lived in New Jersey, and would drive out to my mom's place in Indiana.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, it was built by Schaefer at a time when people took a lot of pride in the brewery and the brewery architecture. You know, that was, brewing was treated as a craft. So you didn't just have, you know, a building that, in an industrial park that looked like a warehouse. You actually had a beautiful red brick building with, you know, copper kettles in the windows.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you at the point where you think you might be looking for another brewery?
Not actively. I mean, if something, what we've learned is, you know, sometimes things come up and, you know, the timing is right. So, they don't, if it's the right thing, it's not available all the time.
Sure. For somebody listening to this call thus far, they would think that life was always sweetness and light for you and just going from a few barrels to a lot of barrels to a lot more barrels. But somewhere along the line, I know for a fact that you had at least one crisis and perhaps more. Could you tell us what your biggest crisis was and how you all met?
You know, I think our biggest crisis was probably, I guess, thinking it was 2008. Mm-hmm. When, you know, we do this hand inspection of bottles. It's called candling. We take samples off the bottling line and run it, you know, look at them by hand in a bright light to look for any odd things in the bottles. And we noticed that there were, we found a couple of bottles that had these glass, small pieces of glass that had chipped off the lip. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we immediately instituted a recall, got all of the bad bottles back, and, you know, that was a crisis. Now, luckily, we were able to get all of the bottles back within a week, and, you know, there was no, you know, minimal issues. You know, nobody got hurt.
Right.
But it was a scary time when we first, you know, when it first erupted.
Right. And, but you seem to have handled it really well, and, you know, it certainly showed the value of knowing who your distributors are and being able to reach out quickly to get product if you have to back from the retailer.
Yeah, we were very fortunate to have really an extraordinary effort on the part of our wholesalers. I mean, we got almost all the bottles back in less than a week,
which is very phenomenal when you think about what happens sometimes in the packaged goods.
Yeah, we got them off the shelves. I mean, this wasn't just from distributors' warehouses. This was off the shelves, you know, with we were able to replace it with new bottles.
Mm-hmm. And apparently without any harm to your reputation either, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's, I think, you know, today people actually give us some credit for how we handled it. And we'll never know, you know, what sales, we'll never know for sure, you know, whether there's any lingering issues or damage, but we felt like we did the right thing, and that was the only choice.
Sure. And that's a natural transition to the question of where do you see Boston Beer Company today as a business?
Well, it's my belief that we're really at still at the beginning of the growth of craft beer in the United States. I mean, I've been trying to educate people for 27 years, and I think it's finally worked. I think there are different attitudes about, you know, quality American beer today than there was when I started. When I started, you know, quality American beer was an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. Today, particularly 20-somethings recognize that the best beers in the world are coming from small independent brewers like Samuel Adams, and I'm optimistic that 20-somethings will they are and will continue to adopt craft beer in the same way that their boomer parents adopted wine. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, that led to 30 years of consistent growth in wine, and I think we could be looking at 30 years of consistent growth in craft beer.
That would be a truly phenomenal stretch for the craft beer business to go.
I feel it's very realistic. Mm-hmm. And again, it goes back to what I learned when I started Sam Adams, was if you give the consumer a really great, interesting glass of beer, they're going to drink it. I mean, it's sort of that simple. I mean, I started Sam Adams with the idea that I can put the best glass of beer available in front of the American beer drinker, and that's led to 27 years of growth for Sam Adams. I think that same principle applies, and Sam Adams and other craft brewers are making the best beers in the world right here in the U.S.
Well, that certainly seems to be the case. Now, you have covered all my questions, but I always wonder if there's something that I should have asked you that I didn't. So, is there anything that you wish I would have asked?
I'm still having fun. still making new beers. Last night I was tasting different barrels, samples from different barrels for the 2011 Utopias. We're continuing. I mean, I'm still having fun creating new beers and pushing the envelope on beer today, just like Boston Lager did back in 1984.
How many different beers do you make now?
If you include everything that we released commercially during a year, it's probably around, if not over, 40.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they range from, very, very small, something that we may make 10 barrels of to, larger. But so we still continue to make very small batches of experimental and extraordinary beers, even as Boston Lager continues to grow. So I'm like in the perfect position. We have the experience and the skills to make lots of extraordinary, innovative beers, and but we're small enough to want to keep doing that.
Mm-hmm. And you are publicly held, but you really control the company still, don't you?
Yes, yes. We're publicly held, but I have all the controlling shares, so it's the best of both worlds.
It certainly sounds like it. Well, I hope that if the company continues to grow, that you find a way to maintain that control rather than have what happens to so many companies where they, the control just sort of dissipates until one day you're owned by the institutional investors.
Oh, no, I don't have that issue because the only public shares are the non-controlling shares.
Good.
Excellent. So I have 100% of the controlling shares. Life is pretty good.
That would be good. Sounds like I know the title for your biography, or autobiography, I should say, when you're ready to write it, which is I Never Worked a Day in My Life.
That's a good title, Joel.
Actually, the title's already been written by one guy, but I suspect that you could write it too, or something close to it.
I like it.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, Jim, this has been a great interview. I really appreciate your time and your insights into the development of Boston beer, and there's a lot of lessons that others can learn from this, not only people in the beer business, but, you know, people in, who are just interested in business and in entrepreneurship in general. So I really, really appreciate your time. And if you'll hang on for just a minute after we conclude this call, I just want to get a little bit of contact information in case I have to get back to you quickly.
Okay.
Let me wrap that up. We've enjoyed talking with Jim Cook today on this expert interview, and we will be scheduling another one within the next 2 weeks, and we'll look forward to having you all listen to it at that time. Bye now.